Without further ado, let me introduce our first speaker, Dr. Len Nichols. Len Nichols is a health economist and the vice president of the respected Center for Studying Health Systems Change. Previously, Dr. Nichols worked for the Urban Institute, the Office of Management and Budget, and he was a visiting fellow at the Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research, now known as ARC. He was also a professor and chair of the Economics Department at Wellesley College. When we were searching for speakers for the seminar, I called the National Conference of State Legislatures, and they said that Dr. Nichols is one of the first people, if not the first person, they turn to when they're doing a seminar on rising healthcare costs. I counted in his CV, in the last 7 years, he's written over 50 publications, 16 working papers. He's given over 60 presentations on healthcare costs, on the health workforce, individual and small group insurance markets, Medicare, Medicaid. He regularly speaks to state legislatures, the National Conference of State Legislatures, the Council of State Governments, the Agency for Healthcare Reform, and Quality User Liaison Program. To give you an idea of the demand he's in November, he spoke to 35 legislators in Colorado. He's giving 9 presentations in January alone. And last week, he spoke to the entire Florida legislature. He very graciously worked with us to write the first chapter of the briefing report. That includes many of the key concepts that he'll be covering. His PowerPoint slides are also tucked inside the briefing report if you want to follow along and take notes. Len, after talking with you, I think you'd like Wisconsin. You know, we really like your work here in Wisconsin. Dr. Nichols was awarded the Most Useful Research Award from the Wisconsin Network for Health Policy. And I know you like college basketball. We've got a good basketball team here and a lot of loyal Badger fans. I know you like live theater. We've got an outdoor Shakespearean theater in Spring Green, where I live. And I know you like canoeing. We've got lots of good canoeing on the Wisconsin River and some other rivers here in Wisconsin. But probably goes without saying, this outdoor theater and canoeing, you might have to come back when it's just a bit warmer outside. So without further ado, let's extend a warm Wisconsin welcome to Len Nichols, who'll discuss why healthcare costs are rising so rapidly.
Well, thanks, Karen. That was a very gracious introduction, and I think I will take you up on coming back when it's just a little warmer than it was this morning. Although I did go to grad school at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, which does not have as good a basketball team as you do, or football, if I recall. But anyway, I do remember my very first semester of teaching assistant there. First day of January, you know, it was 65 below wind chill. So this is nothing compared to that on that day. I also appreciate the introduction. I am an economist. On good days, I'm proud of that. But it is also true that really, and as some people who know me well will tell you, I'm actually a preacher who was kidnapped on the way to seminary and forced to go to graduate school. And it turns out economics is a good place to be for a would-be seminarian because there's a God you can worship efficiency. There's a liturgy that can make you comfortable when you feel nervous, that is mathematics. You know, some people joke about economists were the kind of people who can see something happening perfectly clearly in real life and rush back to the office excitedly to work out the math to see if it's possible. We really do come back and do the math a lot. So in addition to there being a liturgy that makes you feel comfortable, there's also an apocrypha, the teachings of Karl Marx, which can seduce the young and beguile us and confuse us for a long time and really infuriate the professors who know better. So it's a fun place to be for would-be seminarian. Let me say a few words about what we are at HSC, the Center for Studying Health System Change, the single longest think tank name in history. You can guess it's true. It was named by a committee of a foundation. But the idea basically was, out of the Clinton, shall we say, fiasco in 93-94, it became increasingly clear that no single private think tank was trusted by both sides of the aisle. Both parties had their favorite think tanks, and so no one was perceived to be an honest broker. So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation created the center for the purpose of just producing facts. And so for the first 4 years, they just produced facts. Then they hired me to try to talk about the facts. But no, really, the point is to try to create an entity where everybody knows they can trust us to be honest brokers on information. And since our system is changing so rapidly, it turned out to have been an opportune time to do this. We survey households, survey physicians, survey employers. And we also do site visits. Okay, next one. We also do site visits, and this actually is where we get to talk to real people, and turns out that's useful. We're used to flying at 30,000 feet, those of us who do academic research and doing surveys that are representative, but it turns out when you go talk to real people, you learn things about your data you never would have figured out otherwise. And so we go to these 12 communities every other year for a week at a time, talk to over 100 people in each community, and really get a good feel for what's going on the ground. The dots without the names are places we survey individuals, but we don't do a site visit there. Okay, let's go. Okay, so what am I supposed to do today? Well, first I want to talk a little bit about what is the real cost of healthcare cost growth. What do we give up by having costs grow like they do? What do we know about recent trends and sources? What are some of the responses employers are doing all over the nation? This will come both from my work in surveys, but also site visit interviews that we've done with employers just this year. And then some potential feedback loops as you think about policy options for you. Now, this graph is in some ways the only graph I need, because it really does summarize everything in a way there is to say about healthcare cost growth in the United States in the last 40 years. What it is the fraction of our GDP, our total national income, total national product, claimed by national healthcare spending. And you'll see in 1960 it was a little less than 5%, and today it's already up to 14%. We finally did cross the 14% barrier. Aren't we very proud of that? You may recall in the early 90s there were all these projections we'd be at 14% by the mid-90s. It turns out the 90s were a relatively good decade for healthcare cost growth. In fact, each of those bars represents a decade until the last one. And you see, 2000 was relatively close to 1990. It was a relatively slow growth decade. But then, boom, in 2001, we jumped up as much in that 1 year as we did in the whole decade of the 90s. And those data just came out last week. So what do we know this really does over time? Well, fundamentally, it means we give up a great deal of other goods and services we could have in order to pay for our health care. Now, I want to be very quick to add, we like health care. Health care is good. Every society that's rich spends more on health care than societies that are poor. People who are rich spend more on health care than people who are poor. Health care is kind of a luxury good. You want more of it. The question is, do you want as much of it as we're managing to pay for in this nation? And as we talk about how much else you have to give up has something to do with that. As you will learn, and maybe many of you already know, part of the way we finance healthcare in this nation is basically a series of very complicated cross-subsidies. The simplest one is when somebody who's uninsured shows up in the hospital, they get care. They get care that's real, takes real resources. How is that paid for? Well, it's a combination of the hospital itself, the physicians themselves receiving less pay for that, overpayment charged to people who are privately insured, perhaps some direct subsidies from state and local governments. It's a mishmash, but the point is we all share in that cost. Those hidden cross subsidies were kind of easy to deal with when we only spent 5% of GDP on healthcare. When it's 14, suddenly it's very visible, it's very painful, and all of us are saying, I don't want to pay those extra costs, and that's fundamentally what's been driving the pressure to change our healthcare system in the last 20 years. But perhaps the most profound cost, and it really does come home when you think about a family context, as Karen asked me to try to put some of these data in, the real cost of healthcare cost growth is an increasing fraction of our workforce simply can't afford it anymore. Let's go to the next slide. And what this does is shows you the average family premium as a percentage of a number of different income measures. The first bar is the average family premium in the United States as a percentage of the earnings of the average worker. And you see it's about 28%. The premium would cost 28% of what the average worker gets paid. Then the next bars represent what the family premium would cost as a proportion of income for different income quintiles. That is to say, the lowest 20% of our nation's income, what they earn, a family premium is half of that. The second 20% of our nation's families, family premium is over 20% of that. And here's kind of the kicker, it seems to me. The gray bar there in the middle, okay, the third one from the left, that represents what you might call middle. Those are the middle 20% of our nation, the 40th percentile to 60th percentile of income, and a family premium is 15% of their income. I don't know about you, but that's kind of high. And guess what? It's been going up over time, and it's going to continue going up unless we figure out what to do about this. Okay, now I want to switch gears just a bit and talk about what do we buy with our healthcare dollar. You see in the first tranche, 1980, oh, okay, how do you do this? Cool. Okay, 1980, we spent about 40% of our healthcare dollar on hospital care. And over time, basically, that's been coming down. And that basically has to do with the transformation of our healthcare system. We're delivering a much greater share of our care outside the hospital than we were. Note, however, the hospital is still the single most important entity and still the greatest share of healthcare costs, but quite a bit less than it was even 20 years ago. Let me also highlight drugs. Drugs go from 5% to 10. 10 is high, 10 is not 30. So it's still true, even though drugs are growing faster than hospital care, hospital costs are actually the single greatest contributor to healthcare cost growth because their share is still so high. And this shows average compound growth rates for a decade by service component. NHE is national health spending, hospitals down here. And what you see basically is that every component significantly reduced its growth rate on average in the 1990s versus the 1980s, except for drugs. Drugs did a little bit, but it still rocked along around 12%. Note, this has an asterisk because it's a projection by people who do this for a living. We expect healthcare costs to increase in the first decade of the 21st century and drugs to still remain up high. And the point of this slide is this. We had tremendous success in the 1990s in reducing the rate of cost growth. In a fundamental sense, managed care worked. Managed care had a number of effects that slowed the rate of cost growth. However, you may have noticed people didn't like managed care. Managed care worked, and it managed to piss every single human being off in the United States. Docs hated it because it told them what to do and took away their money. Employers hated it because their employees kept complaining. Employees hated it because they kept having to shuffle here, there, and yon, couldn't figure out where, told they couldn't do this, told they couldn't do that. A lot of hassle factor. So what managed care did was reduce healthcare cost growth by restraining use, but it made us all so happy we've now tossed away the strictures and we're going to come back with cost growth. Okay, now I told you that because the share of hospital spending is so high, it's the single most important contributor to healthcare cost growth, even though its rate of cost growth is lower than the rate of cost growth of drugs. And what this slide does is decompose hospital cost growth into price versus quantity. And quantity is really is really two components here. Quantity is really use as well as intensity of services given a visit to a hospital or something like that. So it's a combination of quantity and volume or intensity of services. And what we see is that, of course, healthcare cost growth has accelerated in the last few years. And the proportion of healthcare cost growth that can be attributed to price is actually smaller today as a proportion than it was in 1998. What does that mean? It means most of what's going on lately is use. What's going on is the restrictions of managed care have been taken off, and more people are going to the hospital than they were before, staying longer than they were before, having more stuff done to them in the hospital than they were before, and thus we've re-accelerated our use path from where it was before managed care. Okay, so what's really driving healthcare cost growth now? Fundamental force is the loosening of managed care strictures. Provider capacity constraints were starting to show up. Part of what happened when people thought managed care was here to stay was we started investing less in hospital capacity. We started investing less in a number of different kinds of capacities. And suddenly, with the surge in use, we're finding more and more hospitals having way higher percentage of beds being used than were before. Provider consolidation, it turns out, one of the things people didn't like about managed care was being told they couldn't go to certain doctors or certain hospitals. So managed care plans figured out to be popular, they had to have basically every provider in their network. Well, if you figure out eventually that the health plans need you more than you need the health plans, and you're just a little bit miffed about the way they've treated you for a while, and you think you're doing all these wonderful things for society and not being paid for it, so you need to get your money back. You consolidate, you make a system, you say, you want me, the price is this. You don't want me, there's the door. We wish you great good luck. And all across this great land of ours, hospitals are pushing back, and physicians are watching and doing the very same thing. And so fundamentally what you're seeing is tremendous pushback on health plans, and health plans are weak because health plans don't have the tools to say, well, I don't want you in my network. They can't do that anymore because employers and employees are demanding we want every provider in. The last bullet here is really about information. Direct-to-consumer ads is part of it. But also what we're observing in our surveys is physicians are reporting more and more people are coming in with printouts from the internet saying, you know, I think I need this drug, or I think I need this test, or what about this operation? And so what's happening is in a culture where physicians' authority has been challenged in some ways for good reason. You know, Marcus Welby did retire. It's not quite the same as it used to be. Turns out they're not all perfect. At the same time, they feel compelled to encourage and elicit patient satisfaction. Well, how can you make them happy if you send them away empty-handed? So they're giving them something, even though they may not need anything. And fundamentally, that's leading to an increase in demand for some things. Okay, what are the evidence of capacity constraints? We observe patients reporting longer delays. More and more patients are reporting they have to wait at least a week to get an acute care visit, not a checkup, an acute care visit. More and more physicians are working longer hours. This is a reversal of a long-term trend. And this happened before the stock market fell. This is not driven by portfolio decline. This is driven by response to demand. Emergency room overflow, a fair bit of patient diversion is going on. Again, this is because either beds are full or they don't have enough nurses to staff the beds they do have, and so people get shifted from one hospital to another. As far as we know, no one has died from this yet, but it is serious. It's an indication that capacity is indeed being constrained, and of course, the nursing shortage is legion. It turns out there are other professions, some of the technologist professions inside hospitals, that are even greater shortage than nurses in some parts of the country. Now, I put this slide up here because I want to make two points about it. One, the first bullet here is actually the single most important thing I'm going to tell you. Write this down. What drives healthcare cost growth over the long haul is technology. That is to say, is improving technology, things we're getting better at. That's the single most important source. We like it. It's good. It turns out it does add value on average across the board. At the same time, it is very, very expensive. And at the same time, you might ask the question, are we getting true value for dollar? Are we getting the right technology? Are we getting too much technology of this kind, not enough of that kind? That's really the fundamental question. But I would just say the reason we spend 14% of GDP now versus 40 years ago is technology. The other things I put there because everybody thinks they're really important to drive healthcare cost growth, and in fact, they're not. They do have effects. Aging is important. We are aging as a society. But, thank goodness, we're aging slowly. So that aging adds a little less than 1% to our cost growth each year. It adds about 0.6 tenths, in fact. Now, 20 years ago, it added 0.2. 0.6 is bigger than 0.2, but both are less than 1. And the point is, that's not the major thing driving healthcare cost growth. The level of cost of myself today is higher than it was when I was 22 and immortal. Okay, but at the same time, the rate of growth of our nation's costs is not being driven by the aging. Transactions cost, that has to do with all the stuff that providers go through and insurance companies go through that's not related to patient care. It's a non-trivial chunk of our healthcare activity. It's a non-trivial, you know, all the regulations, all that stuff. It matters. But it matters for the level. It doesn't change a lot year to year. So it doesn't really drive healthcare cost growth. It affects the level of cost where we have been for quite some time. Same thing for benefit mandates. Mandates are expensive. They can be extremely expensive for small businesses who didn't cover, say, inpatient mental or in vitro fertilization or stuff like that. But at the same time, again, most of the mandates in place in the nation have been in place for 15 years. So it's really hard to say that mandates are driving healthcare cost growth this year, but they weren't doing it in the 1990s when we had low cost growth. So the point is, mandates affect the level, but not the rate of growth over time, on average, across the nation. Same thing for inappropriate care. We have a lot of inappropriate care in the United States. That is to say, we have very uneven quality. But again, there's no reason to think it's getting tremendously worse today than it was 5 years ago. Okay, what do I know that employers are doing around the country? What are they really responding to? And you're going to hear a lot more about that from Rick and John as we go through the day. But I want to remind you that, you know, employers, as you know, 70% of our nation gets their health insurance at the workplace. It's would have been that way for a very long time, probably will always be that way, unless we manage to screw it up somehow. But the point really is, employers offer health insurance not out of altruism, but to compete for labor. Fundamentally, employer groups are very efficient mechanisms for organizing risk pools, for organizing groups of people to buy health insurance at a place where insurers are happy to sell to them. It's very efficient, even in aside from the tax break, which is important, but actually not more important, in fact, maybe not as important, as the risk pooling and administrative efficiencies that can be gained from a large group. So they do it to compete for labor. What are they doing now to face in the face of these high premium increases? Well, they're basically increasing employee cost sharing across the board, lots of different ways. We can talk about that in some detail. At the same time, they're beginning to demand much more accountability on the part of providers and our plans to show them value for dollar as we go through time. So one of the questions is, as we give the employee more responsibility, as we give them, in a way, more power to make decisions about their healthcare choices, and at the same time give them more responsibility and a higher cost-sharing amount for each choice, will this new system work? Well, one set of questions is, can consumer empowerment occur if we don't agree on how to measure quality? And I would just say, I'll leave it as a question. I think there's a lot of work that's been done on this, and Lord knows we'll do more. But at the same time, we're not really ready to trade quality versus cost in a fully informed way across this nation for every choice. And because of that, basically, just giving people higher co-payments is not necessarily going to push us quickly to where we want to be. To do that, you've got to have an information infrastructure. You've got to have provider buy-in. One of the big mistakes the Clinton plan made, I would observe, is that it turned insurers and physicians into the enemy. Hello, you are not going to reform your healthcare system if insurers and physicians are the enemy. You've got to have them part of the system. And fundamentally, then, what you need is provider buy-in on how you measure quality. You can't impose it from economists. You can't impose it from God. You've got to have the docs agree on how to measure quality. And until you get that, you're not going to really get this stuff. So let's keep going. Yeah. Next slide. Okay. So some then say, okay, if we don't have enough good quality information at the moment to really have a powerful consumer movement, how well will cost sharing work this time? We've had cost sharing before, after all. We had high cost sharing in the 1970s, before we had managed care. We've been there. And guess what? That's when healthcare costs were growing pretty rapidly, too, you may recall from that first graph. So, will it work better this time? Some say probably not. Again, we've been there before. The Rand Health Insurance Experiment in the 70s showed that when people are faced with high cost sharing, they tend to cut back on both efficacious and non-efficacious care. That is to say, people don't know much about what to cut back on. Now, the advocates today say, yeah, but today's different. You know what? There's an internet. There's WebMD. And you know what? They're right. The potential to be much better informed is clearly incredibly greater today than it was in the 1970s. The question is, can you infuse that drive to be informed throughout your population? And I'll say that that's a fundamental question. Okay. So what are the feedback loops in healthcare cost growth cycles? Well, when you try to contain healthcare cost growth, one of the fundamental constraints is one person's cost is somebody else's income. So it turns out that makes your jobs as legislators really hard, because you can't push without somebody screaming every time. Cost shifting is always popular, doesn't work in the long run, and you know that. Basically, as I said before, we all pay for the uninsured one way or another, which means fundamentally we're linked in this system because we're going to give them care, and then the question is, how do you pay for it, and what are the consequences of that on the rest of us? And it turns out, of course, it's higher premiums and higher taxes. And I would say the ultimate limit on what a society is going to pay for health care is fundamentally what it's willing to pay for the services that it's getting. And that's why I keep coming back to the most important thing we can do, I think, is organize ourselves to evaluate the technology and the services we might be getting. Are we getting value for dollar? That's a question we should answer. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much. Let's give him a hand. Okay, we've got 5 minutes for questions for Dr. Nichols. And we want you to speak into the mic. Ross Cullen, one of the graduate students at the University of Wisconsin, is working with me on family policy and law, will be handling the mic. Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you. I couldn't tell if it was working. Yeah, you indicated that in the U.S., 15% of our gross national product is devoted to health care. In other modern industrialized countries, What is that percentage, and why is there a difference between the U.S. and other industrialized countries?
Great question. In the United States today, we're now up to 14.1% of GDP. The country closest to us is Canada, and it's about 10% of GDP. Most nations are between 6 and 10. So you ask sort of why. Well, one thing you might answer is, so what are we getting for this money? Well, if you compare us on the basis of aggregate statistics that are typically used to evaluate whole systems, infant mortality, life expectancy, we actually do very badly. Infant mortality, we're in the mid-20s. That is to say, we're like 23rd, 24th, something like that. We bounce around. Life expectancy at birth, we're in the high teens. So you think, well, maybe that's because we have all these uninsured people in other nations that we compare ourselves to typically have universal coverage. So what if we just do life expectancy at 65, from which point, of course, all Americans are covered by Medicare? There we're 12th. You could say, well, maybe our society is more heterogeneous than other societies. We've got all these different kinds of cultures and societies. Compare us to Israel. Israel has incorporated many, many different populations that are quite different than the Ashkenazi elite that organize the state. They count the Arabs in East Jerusalem since 1967, and Israel went from being below us in all these measures to being ahead of us now in 1995. So we don't get what we need. At the same time, ask the simple question, where do the Saudi princes come? They come here. Are they stupid? I don't think so. The point is, we have very, very, very high quality. We also have very uneven quality, and we have great inequity. So why do we spend more? Well, I would say at the core, we do it because we're individualistic. We don't want one system. We don't want one size fits all. We don't want government command and control. Every society with universal health care has fundamentally government control over supply of services and government control over who gets it. And we prefer to have a much greater choice, much more fragmented system, much more freedom. We have more liberty to spend more money, and we don't manage to give it to everyone because it costs so much.
Another question. Over here.
Thank you. In your statistics, the implication seems to be that at the heart of the cost problem, you have providers as opposed to insurers, hospitals, doctors, drug companies, and the interaction that needs to take place seems to be an interaction between purchasers, meaning employers or employers, users, and providers, and the middleman function, sort of trying to put pressure on the middleman, the insurer, to try to put control on the providers, is an interaction that has not been particularly successful. And with the use of information, an interaction between purchasers and providers would be a helpful step in doing things to control cost. Is that a fair equation?
I think that is a fair read, and I think your statement is quite profound, actually, because fundamentally we tried to hire insurers to do our business. And again, they managed to do it for 5 or 7 years by constraining access to services, but they managed to do it in such a way that it made us all very, very unhappy. We didn't like the way they did it. And I think, you know, when I go back and think about where were we when we thought about the Clinton plan versus the Breaux plan versus the Cooper plan versus the Chafee plan, all that stuff, all those plans essentially had the health plan, the health insurer, as the core unit. It was going to be the enforcer. Well, at the end of the day, what I'm trying to tell you is I think now the most important interaction is between the patient and the provider. Until we get the incentives right at that level, frankly, sports fans, it doesn't matter much what happens up here at the intermediate level. At the end of the day, all insurers can do is what their purchasers tell them to do. Their purchasers told them to go forth and save money, and then their purchasers told them, my employees are too unhappy, back off. And the insurers did it every time. They are, by nature, the middleman. Having said that, I will say insurance companies can play incredibly valuable roles in the information infrastructure. We need them in order to evaluate the providers, maybe. But at the same time, I don't think they are not going to solve our problem for us. It's going to have to be patient, provider, and then purchaser.